Okay, now on number 10, you're talking about, how exactly, I'll just read the last sentence of this long question. How exactly does eliminating tests of mental ability damage education and the economy? Well, one can learn something about this from the armed forces, which, and what they found, would apply in large measure to private industry. And that is when people have to be trained for the jobs that they do, and this is very often the case because the schools haven't trained people for the specifics of any given particular kind of job. You have to put people through some kind of training program if the job involves any complexity of skills at all. Mm-hmm. That a certain percentage of people selected at random will not pass the training course. Mm-hmm. Or they will take much longer. They'll have to go through the course at a much slower rate or have to repeat it in mm-hmm. order to come up to a satisfactory level of performance. Mm-hmm. If you pick people at random, job applicants at random, for any kind of training program that prepares them for doing the specific job that the employer wants done, the people will differ quite markedly in the success with which they get through such a program. Some won't get through at all. Some will take anywhere from slightly longer to get through to as much as 10 times longer to get through. Some will only get through if they repeat the program one or two times, that is the training program,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So if one wants to have any kind of efficiency, one would want to select the persons who are most likely to succeed in a training program that's of some reasonable length to accommodate the number of employees that you want to put through this program.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's simply a matter of efficiency. No football coach would select players at random because it would be the average would be lowered of what he got after training from what he would get if he very carefully selected the players before he began their training, and the ease of training and efficiency of training would differ markedly from a randomly selected sample in a group that was selected for athletic talent. And any high school coach knows this.
Uh-huh.
And the armed forces know it, and employers know it. And it's been found that the best and most objective means of selecting people for this purpose is by means of tests. Interviews are notoriously poor for this purpose. Past work records, work histories are quite good, but often you're employing people who will have to be trained for a specific job where there's no job that was like it before. You can't hire someone to do this job who's already experienced in it. You have to put them through a training program. And this is the case in many of the things that have to be done in the armed forces. They have all of these, for example, Navy training schools. And the training schools differ in the cognitive demands that they make for the particular kind of training. Being trained for an electronics technician makes much greater cognitive demands than being trained as a cook, for example.
So before people used IQ tests at all, I mean, they would have to use these other criteria, which you know, like you say, an interview is notoriously
That's
unreliable.
Right. They used those criteria,
and,
but also, in an earlier time, many people learned these by an apprenticeship relationship with someone who did it. In the days before, you know, of mass hiring in large factories and so forth,
uh-huh.
a kid who wants to learn to be a blacksmith goes and works with a blacksmith as an apprentice. And if he shows no talent for it, the blacksmith would get rid of him and get another kid who shows some aptitude for learning smithing, and so on. And there would be quite an apprenticeship period. And children were often apprenticed to their parents in given occupations. And so efficiency and so forth weren't the order of the day. You didn't have 200 applicants for 10 jobs. So there was no need for selection. And that's still the case in certain occupations in certain parts of the world today. But in places where specific training is required, required for jobs, particularly, then selection tests are a very economical way of running your program. Because the least efficient way is just to select people at random by lottery.
Well, because
we know that aptitudes for learning a particular kind of thing differ enormously in the population.
I think you said earlier in this interview, you know, on Wednesday, that the correlation between IQ and education is becoming lower now. Did you say that?
Yes, somewhat, because of the fact that by education, I mean the number of years spent in school.
Right.
And that's because the school system has worked very hard to prevent dropout. The aim is to keep as many kids in school as possible until they're 18 years of age.
Well, I was thinking that since education is often used as one criterion for selection for jobs, maybe they would use tests too, but they would often use education either, you know, in combination
sure.
with a test or even entirely
right.
as the criterion. Wouldn't the lessening of the correlation between IQ and education mean that society is not discriminating as well in selection of people, and so this would result in a lot more hiring mistakes and would be worse for the economy?
That's true. There's still a high enough correlation that if one can't use tests, the next best thing to use is the amount of education a person has had. And the Navy people tell me that the difference between an 11th grade dropout and a 12th grade graduate is a much bigger gap than you would think for just one more year of education. It's the fact of finishing apparently adds some greater increment of favorable prediction for that person than would be expected just from one more year spent in school. The fact that the person stays in school until he's reached some formal finishing point apparently carries quite a lot of weight. And so, but among all high school graduates, let's see, there's still going to be a tremendous range of abilities. And you'd still want to select within that group. But if you couldn't do that, then one would want to select in terms of how many years of schooling the person has had.
Do you think we would be better off if we had a system similar to what they have in Europe, I think, where they send more people to vocational school? I mean, do you think that would be better?
Oh, decidedly, because I think that there's a very, you know, substantial segment of the population, perhaps as many as 30% of the total population, who have no or very little aptitude and virtually no interest in an academic education at the high school level. So that beyond about age 12, say about where the 8th grade would finish, there's really nothing much left in a regular academic school for these people, and they would be much better off in a some kind of vocational school learning more specialized employable skills.
Why aren't we doing this? I mean, is it because they're worried that too many people would, you know, that the racial differences would be too great?
I think the racial thing has a lot to do with it, and also the idea that everyone should have an equal opportunity to be president of Harvard or of the United States or win a Nobel Prize and so on, and that you're depriving people of that if you get them on a track as early as, say, age 12 or so.
I see.
That doesn't lead to a PhD in nuclear physics.
Yeah. It's like the denial of the existence of significant individual differences. As well as, you know, the group difference thing.
That's right, yes. It's as if everyone who was really given a full opportunity and who really wanted to should be able to do any of those things. You know, they can be Beethoven or Einstein or whatever if they really want to. And so you shouldn't deprive anyone of the kind of education that it would take to reach that level. Silly notion, of course, but I think this is what's behind this kind of thinking in large part. What one does have to do, and what they've discovered in England, of course, is that there does have to be a provision for late bloomers, because there are such children as late bloomers who don't show much academic promise early in life. Stephen Hawking, you know, this brilliant theoretical physicist from Cambridge University, who's got a bestseller book out now on...
Is he, he has some kind of thing like cerebral palsy or something?
No, he has Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh.
And he's totally paralyzed and so forth, but he's... I mean, many consider him the greatest mind in physics since Einstein. But he claims that he didn't seem to be much good at anything as a kid. And it took a while for him to discover his talent and so forth. Well, if he'd gotten shut it off into a vocational school or so, he may never become a professor of physics at Cambridge. He now holds Newton's chair, the same chair that Newton had, occasion professor of mathematics at Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
He's really a chair of theoretical physics now. But, so one has to have some provision for persons to be re-examined periodically and to change tracks and so forth if their abilities seem to warrant it. But
or
try
even,
to
even
all kids through this kind of an academic program, I've seen, you know, just ridiculous extremes in this. Kids who can't do fractions, they try to put into advanced math courses and so forth to ensure that they had equal representation of different racial groups in some of these courses.
Yeah, it's extremely unkind when you think about it, because they're bound to be unhappy and upset and feel terrible about it.
Well, right. I think that this is the root of a great deal of the violence and vandalism one sees in schools today. The school program is so frustrating, and there's a well-known principle, you might say, in psychology that frustration leads to aggression. And, you know, the frustration-aggression hypothesis. And I think that one is seeing a great deal of that in the schools today. Kids being retained in schools that have programs that are totally irrelevant to those children, and they're simply frustrated and hostile. They take it out on the teachers and on the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know a number of people who've been teachers who just have had to choose a different occupation because they were just... you know, there was so much violence, and they were constantly afraid.
Yes, well, we know that, I mean, just in recent weeks, there have been news items in the paper about teachers being beat up and hospitalized and even murdered by pupils. And this occurs in these schools, almost exclusively in these schools, where the children are extremely frustrated by the school program because they're just not accomplishing anything that is of any tangible value to them. I mean, they're not able to do the level of work that the school is demanding.
Mm-hmm.
They spend years, you know, trying to master a rather elementary thing. They could be spending that same amount of time learning skills and so forth that would be more useful to them once they're out of their years of school.
Or even if people had, you know, the opportunity to go into vocational schools, even if that were, you know, even if they didn't say, okay, if you don't pass the test, you go to this school, if you do, you go to this other school, if you just, you know, gave people more of the opportunity, I think it would probably be that the ones who are smarter would gravitate towards the more academic things, and then the ones who weren't so smart would, you know, naturally want to do something practical.
Well, that doesn't actually hold. It's not a linear relationship there. And it's confounded with racial pride.
Uh-huh.
They found a Berkeley professor, for example, actually did a study on this some years ago in a predominantly lower socioeconomic school district here in the Bay Area. And he found that, you know, relatively low white kids, low IQ white kids, would opt for the vocational courses. But black kids of the same level of IQ would not, and often resisted going into them. They they wanted to be in the academic track, even though they were flunking in those tracks. Because there was something, they regarded it as demeaning to go into a vocational track.
Yeah.
And that idea has been put into them, I think, largely
right.
by our society and the media and so on. And it's a shame, really. But until those kinds of values and attitudes are changed, I think we'll still have this problem of children preferring to flunk algebra rather than get a good grade in auto shop or something.
Uh-huh.
So, and then there's another problem that's never mentioned with regard to this racial difference. And that is that one-fourth of blacks actually score below about an IQ of 75, which is rather universally regarded as a cutoff for mental retardation. Some people put it at 70, some at 80. But somewhere in the California schools, an IQ of 75 is the cutoff for mental retardation. And persons below 75 seem to be retarded by almost any standard except by the standards of people who are themselves in that category. And about 25%, that's one in four blacks in the United States, would fall into that category.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a fairly large segment of the population. And anything resembling academics beyond about a sixth grade level is just out of reach by such people. No one has discovered any means by which you can really get more than about a sixth grade education
well,
into such people.
Are there classes for mentally retired people? Like, I know there used to be, but have there been?
Well, there still are, of course, yes, and many of these children are in such classes. But what I'm saying is that when these children leave school, they are rarely above a sixth grade level in any of the kinds of skills that we associate with formal schooling.
Uh-huh.
And they're not even very good at acquiring the skills that are required in the trades.
Well,
it takes an average level of intelligence to be a good, or just a reasonably good carpenter.
Uh-huh.
Or a carpenter's helper, even. You've got to be able to measure things. You've got to be able to reason out problems that occur in the construction of something and so on. And we know that persons below about IQ 75 appear very handicapped when given any kind of a task that isn't extremely simple and routine, such as coring apples or in a cannery or working a letter opening machine or something like that. It's extremely simple and routine.
Yeah, it's interesting how on all of these issues, I mean, the public is so completely misled because I remember seeing things on TV where they talk about the handicapped, mentally handicapped, and then they say, well, they're just slower than other people catching on. But, I mean, and the word retarded itself. But, I mean, it's kind of misleading, you know.
Well, it is really quite misleading, yes. They're slower in developing during the course of childhood and so forth. And they are slower at whatever they learn, but there's much more to it than just slowness.
Right.
I mean, these people would not learn algebra if they had 10 years in which to do it, whereas the average school kid can get through the first year's course in algebra in 1 year.
Right.
And a person with an IQ of 75 would never come up to the level of the average kid who's taken a course in eighth grade algebra.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how long he spent at it. So it is misleading to say they're simply just slower. They are that, but they also have a low ceiling of what they are able to accomplish in terms of cognitive complexity.
Right.
And it may not have been a problem, and may still not be a problem, in certain agrarian cultures where the work remains extremely simple. plow around and picking what grows and things like that. But even in those cases, there, in any given village, primitive village, there would be brighter people who would make the important judgments as to when to plant and this, that, and the other thing. And another thing that isn't realized is that what we are seeing results of now in some big cities is what I would call a critical mass of persons who are in this very low IQ category, say below, where all of the people in the in this neighborhood, let's say, are below 85 or 90, and the average may be somewhere around 75. You could then get a kind of a critical mass so that rather intellectually deficient persons are not buffered by more responsible thinking people. You see? Mentally retarded in a society where the average level of ability is fairly high are not conspicuous and are not at risk so much, I mean, for, to themselves or to the society, because they're so well buffered by others who can look after them and supervise their activities and so on. But when you get a critical mass of those people without any buffering elements in the community, then you have a situation which is amounts to a kind of social pathology. And I've talked to social work people in New York, for example, about the kind of social work services that are necessary in some whole neighborhoods of New York, and it's really quite incredible to see that other people have to go in there to see that these people survive, in a sense, that the children eat on a regular basis, and that sick children are taken care of, and so on, because the parents don't do any of this. And it isn't just a wanton negligence on their part, it's an incapacity to see the problem.
Yeah, it's interesting, the idea of the critical mass, you know, and the lack of having, the lack of smarter people to buffer the bad decisions and the poor judgment.
Well, I was at a meeting of school people once, well, this is where I got this idea. I was at this school meeting, and one of the things that came up in the discussion, it was a meeting years ago when they were talking about integrating the Berkeley schools, and the one of the strongest arguments for integrating the schools, but one which has never gotten out to the public, is that it helps to crack up, break up the critical mass and distribute it around to a lot of schools so that it's buffered enough that the teachers can cope with the situation and that a school can still seem like a school. Because if you get too much of this low ability in one school, then the school ceases to resemble a school in any recognizable sense. You get this critical mass and all kinds of problems in that particular school. And by spreading this problem around to a lot of schools, it, it in a sense, disappears. The critical mass that creates the terrific social pathology is broken up, and it doesn't occur to nearly the same degree. But that's the kind of thinking that you'll hear in talk among school people, but we'll never see in the press or in any formal writing in this area. Well, I'll let you go on with it. You want to go on to the next item, or?
Okay.
Well, let's see, this involves the Hunter and Schmidt estimates of how much is actually saved by hiring on the basis of selection tests by the government and so on. I'm simply not able to comment on that. I'm aware of their work. I have heard that some economists have criticized their specific estimates. There's no question that there is some great saving to employers and to the government in hiring people who are selected by means of tests. But what this amount is, or it can only be estimated, of course, because you don't faster, less efficient method of selection. So there's a lot of debate as to just how to go about estimating what the cost is. Some people disagree with Hunter and Schmidt's exact estimate. But no one disagrees that it is some very considerable amount. It's not a trivial amount that could be ignored.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I can say about that, because I haven't looked into the technicalities of the argument as to, you know, what the objections to Hunter and Smith's particular method is, and so on.
Yeah.
One of the critics on this, I think, is a fellow named Levin, Levine at Stanford University. He's an economist there, he's an education economics. And I've heard that he is one of the more vociferous critics of Hunter and Schmidt on this.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot his first name exactly. It's not Michael. There's another Michael Levin, New York University, and it's not that Levin. I'd have to look up the fellow's name. I've got it someplace here. But I don't know him personally. But, I've heard that he is one of their critics. It's not important that he mentioned, but I simply mentioned the fact that their figures can't just be taken at face value without acknowledging that there is some question about them in the eyes of other experts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, question number 12 is opposition to the use of mental tests in any way organized. It certainly is. There are certain organizations, very powerful organizations, which are opposed to the use of tests or at least certain tests. Of course, the Association, American Association of Black Psychologists, has been very much opposed to the use of tests in school, and of course, they were the ones who instigated the Larry P. case,
mm-hmm.
which resulted in the banning of tests for use with Hispanic and black children. I think maybe it's only black children now who cannot be tested for any kind of placement decision. Placement in special classes of any kind.
Is this in California?
In California, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this is the famous Larry P. decision, and the group that was behind that was the Association of Black Psychologists. One of the leaders in that group is a man named Harold Dent, a black clinical psychologist. And Asa Hilliard was another one. He's a professor at the University of Georgia. So that's one group. The largest and most powerful group is probably the National Education Association, which I think is one of the first or second largest lobbies in Washington. And, of course, they're strongly opposed to the use of teacher selection tests, teacher competency tests, and so on. And some unions are probably opposed to the use of tests, but I can't name any specific unions, but the National Teachers Association acts like a union in this respect, trying to protect the interests of its membership and so forth by doing things that to try to put down the use of tests. They've published books attacking tests, and they've held large meetings and conferences and so forth attacking tests, and this is just part of their official policy. And now there's a new group called Fair Test, and they put out a newsletter called the Fair Test Examiner, and they put out many publications, and they recently had a conference, I believe, in Washington, D.C., that was attended by maybe something between 100 and 200 people. And this Harold Dent, whom I mentioned earlier, the black clinical psychologist, is one of the leaders in this group. And the group is made up largely of activists, left-wing types, a lot of lawyers. There are very few, if any, psychometricians or professional persons in this group who are experts in the test field. Their newsletter consists of constantly mentioning various group differences, like black-white differences, black and white Hispanic differences and sex differences and so on, and it's largely propaganda. ad hoc criticisms at the item level. They hold up specific test items for ridicule and so on, and don't seem to be cognizant of any of the actual literature about test bias. But they have been successful in influencing politicians. They've blocked the teacher qualification tests in Alabama. They've blocked the use of IQ tests and standardized achievement tests, I believe, in the elementary schools of North Carolina, and they're very active in New York State. And so they seem to be a growing and increasingly strong group that does have influence on politicians and the like.
Are they affiliated in any way with Science for the People?
Not to my knowledge. There may be overlap in the membership, and it's interesting that both of those groups have their headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Both originated there, apparently.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's... I just happened to run into a thing in the paper about fair tests, and I noticed that they were in Cambridge, so I thought, So I wrote off to them, but I haven't gotten anything yet.
Yeah, well, they may send you a list of their publications and so forth, and it might be worth your while to buy a few, although they're rather exorbitantly expensive.
Well, I hate to contribute anything, even a penny, to their cause, but I think it might be worthwhile to kind of, you know, spy on them a little bit.
Right, oh, absolutely, sure. I know someone who did that by going to their recent conference. He's not a member. In fact, he's quite opposed to them, but he just attended the conference as if he were a member, just to see what was going on.
Uh-huh. Well, it's like, even in the Eugenics Special Interest Group, which is a tiny, tiny organization, I know that there are people who are just, who are completely hostile to our point of view, but they just want to keep an eye on us, you know.
Yeah, well, you're always going to have that. I have people who take my classes on that basis. I've had students from the SGS actually enroll in my classes so that I couldn't put them out on the grounds that they were just auditors or something. And so you simply deal with these people. That seems all right to me. I mean, legitimate thing for people to, inform themselves of what others are doing.
Sure.
Okay, now what about supporters of mental tests? Is there even a loose-knit organization of them? Well, there are organizations, but they're not organizations that are, whose aim is to support mental tests particularly. They're very different kinds of organizations. They're not propaganda organizations in any sense. They're not organizations that are out to criticize the groups that are attacking tests. There are organizations such as the Psychometric Society, which is the most ivory tower group of people anyone would ever want to find. I mean, they deal largely in psychometric esoterica.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much the same could be said for the... for the Division 5 of the American Psychological Association, the Division of Measurement and Psychometrics. Tests and Measurements, Educational Psychological Measurement, and so on. Those divisions don't seem to take much of a stand against their critics, and they themselves have a lot of internal dissension about technical matters. So that a critic can go into those organizations and say, look, the experts can't even agree. But what they're disagreeing about is not the things that the critics are holding up to the public. They're disagreeing about technical esoteric points.
Mm-hmm.
I've even heard some of those groups as... some of the people in those groups are described as having the foxes guard the hen house. I mean, they're people who themselves are willing accomplices to the propagandistic critics of tests.
Well, I can't understand that. I mean, what's the matter with these people? You know.
Well, I think, well, that gets into speculation. population. I don't know what's the matter with them, but I do know there are people who seem to dislike their own chosen field, in a sense, and try to tear it down. I mean, they make their own reputation as critics within their own field, and they never suggest anything constructive to improve the situations that they're criticizing. And they simply, I mean, they're persons, for example, who are quite noted measurement specialists, psychometricians and so forth, who have no use for any kinds of mental tests. I don't know what they're doing in this field. They contribute nothing to improving mental tests, but their whole careers are dedicated to tearing them down and tearing down any methodology that's suggested for improving the situation.
Well, maybe it's just some kind of, unfortunate personality trait of destructiveness or...
I think so. I heard it suggested that these are people
sort of
who've had trouble with their fathers. And they see the authority figures in their field or the field itself sort of as the establishment or as the fathers that they're constantly fighting against.
Yeah, but an awful lot of people have had trouble with their fathers.
Yeah.
I mean, you know... But I have known people who are just, critical of every single thing, and they're very,
Well, there seem to be some sort of, you might almost say, born dissidents.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, there are dissidents here who may sympathize with the Soviet Union, Soviet policies on everything, but if they were there, they would be dissidents there.
Right.
And, they're just born dissidents. There are people like that. I think it's a personality trait. And some of these, you'll probably find these people in every field. And you simply have to put up with them. But
well,
it's surprising how little they're criticized by their colleagues, by other people, in the organizations to which these people belong.
Well, I'll just pass this along without any comment, but I think it was Roger Pearson who said to Nathaniel Wall, that he thought that in the academic world, Jews as a whole were disruptive. And I just thought it was an interesting word, of disruptive. I mean, some of my best friends are Jews, and, I'm not anti-Semitic or anything like that, but I am always looking out for, things so that I can understand better what is
right.
Characteristic of Jews and what is not. And actually, this is getting a little far afield here, but Nathaniel and Sylvia, his wife, and I have discussed the basis of anti-Semitism at great length and have come up with some rather, what I thought were rather interesting and possibly original ideas. And, it goes beyond just the idea of, well, people are envious because they're rich, I mean, that's certainly part of it, I think, but I don't think that's all of it.
Yeah, well, not only rich, but successful. Some who aren't rich are extremely successful.
Right.
Either they're Nobel Prize winners or this, that, or the other thing. This is fairly true of other groups. For example, the Chinese in Southeast Asia, where they're a minority in certain countries like Malaysia and so forth,
uh-huh.
There's a lot of prejudice against them because they're the successful minority.
Yeah.
There's a lot of prejudice against Indians, that is East Indians, in Africa because they're a successful minority.
Uh-huh.
And there is, even in England, a prejudice against East Indians, mainly because of their success as a minority there. They hold more high-level jobs than their proportion in the population would predict.
Mm-hmm.
And many Britishers resent this. And so I think that maybe any group that becomes rather conspicuously successful compared with the majority that was there before these people came on the scene may be resented.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be, I figure, is a large part of it with Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I think of some of the dissident types in my own field and so forth, there do seem to be quite a number of Jews who come to mind.
Yeah.
But then there are quite a number of Jews in the field itself, so it would take some actual research to determine whether that proportion of dissident types is any greater than the proportion of people in the field, of Jews in the field itself. See what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, if I had to guess, I would guess that there would be a difference, just from my own personal experience.
Yeah.
But
well, let's look at who some of the big dissidents are with respect to the study of individual differences, genetic differences, and so forth. There's Stephen Jay Gould.
Right.
There's Richard Lewontin.
Mm-hmm.
There's Leon Kamen.
Right.
There's Jerry Hirsch.
Uh-huh.
There's Peter Schoenemann.
Right.
Now, those are just the first few that came to mind.
Right.
I mean,
I think, okay, you could easily look at the question of your critics versus your supporters.
Right.
And, you know, Jews versus non-Jews. And I mean, it just struck me from way back that there's a very clear preponderance of Jews, you know, who are attacking
right.
you. And the only one I know who supports you, well, there's Nathaniel Weil, and there's somebody else who used to, wasn't there somebody like Kagan or something like that, who used to be against you and then he changed his mind?
Yeah, right, Jerome Kagan.
Right.
And then there's Richard Herrnstein.
Right, uh-huh.
There's Bernard Rimland.
Oh, yeah, right. yeah,
I
think
he's
neat.
There's a... I'm not sure about H.J. Eysenck, but I know his wife is Jewish because she's the daughter of a very famous Jewish concert violinist, so I know she is. I'm not sure about him.
Didn't he escape from Nazi Germany?
Right, he did, yeah. And so, you know, you could name a good number of Jews in this category, too. There's Bernard Davis, the Harvard professor. Harvard Medical School is one of my strongest supporters. There's Robert Gordon.
Is Gordon, I mean, is that a Jewish name?
Well, I don't know what it's a Jewish name, but he's Jewish.
Oh, uh-huh.
And there's his wife, Linda Gottfredson, who's Jewish. Oh, my. You know, I could make a longer list of Jewish supporters than I could have opponents. Actually, it may just be because there's so many Jews in the field.
Yeah, I could see it. I realize that it's very easy to be mistaken in terms of your casual observation. And I think you quoted Galton somewhere.